The Oxford Sparks Podcast, Episode 12, Land, Sea and Air, Part 2.
We work on the largest ecosystem on Earth, which is the ocean. That comprises about 1.3 billion cubic kilometres of water. So obviously we can't work on all of it, but we're particularly interested in what I call hotspot ecosystems in the oceans, particularly in the deep sea, but also tropical coral reefs as well. So this is what we call extreme biodiversity. So it's both biodiversity of ecosystems in the extremes of the ocean, the deep sea or the Southern Ocean, for example, or marine ecosystems characterized by extremely high levels of species richness. My name is Alex Rogers. I'm Professor of Conservation Biology at the Department of Zoology in Oxford, and I'm also a Fellow of Somerville College, where I've been acting as Scientific Advisor for the Global Ocean Commission. We focus on a number of hotspot ecosystems in the deep ocean, particularly what we call cold water coral reefs. Many people won't realise that we get very complex coral ecosystems down to depths of 1.5 kilometres or more in the deep ocean. We also work on underwater mountains, known as seamounts, and we work on deep sea hydrothermal vent ecosystems. So these are hot volcanic springs, if you like, which sit on the seabed at depths of up to 5,000 metres have been found so far. Certainly in the cases we've been looking at, the water exits the seabed at temperatures up to nearly 400 degrees C. So these really are very extreme environments, and the fluids typically are very acidic. They're full of all sorts of very nasty chemicals like hydrogen sulfide, heavy metals and so on. But there are animals which are adapted to living in those very hostile environments.
What sort of animals can survive in these extreme conditions?
Some of the animals will be familiar to anyone who's been on the seashore or has been out on a fishing boat. So we see fish, deep sea fish obviously, which do look pretty weird, some of them. We see crabs, we see corals, things like that. However, some organisms only occur really in the deep oceans. These include things like stork crinoids, which anybody who's listening who collects fossils will know about, because these were very common animals in shallow water marine ecosystems throughout the Carboniferous and various other times in the past, but now these animals only live in the deep ocean. We see animals which have close relatives in shallow water, but which have evolved in very strange ways to cope with the extreme environment of the deep ocean. So, for example, we have sponges in the deep sea, but the sponges in the deep sea are often carnivorous, so they eat other animals. And the reason for this is that almost all the food in most deep sea ecosystems actually sinks down from the upper ocean, from the sea surface. So these are very food-limited ecosystems, and animals have to have all sorts of special adaptations to cope with a very low supply of food.
How have Alex and his team explored these environments?
That's very much dependent on which ecosystem. For the deep sea, obviously, we can't go down there in person. Actually, that's wrong. We do go down there in person very occasionally, but more often we actually use robots called remotely operated vehicles. The vehicle we've used most often is a vehicle called ISIS, which is a UK national facility. And that particular robot is tethered to the ship via a cable and can dive to depths as great as 6,500 metres. It can pick up specimens of animals for us, can take water samples, it can hoover up animals as a special suction gun, and it can even map the seabed using very high resolution acoustics. So we actually get a picture of the seabed from sound, a effectively. That is a fantastic tool. We really, really love using it because we get live pictures from the seabed. You know, as we discover things, we see them actually in situ, and we can tell the pilots exactly what to pick up and sample and so on. So it's a tremendously exciting tool to use.
Many of the challenges in exploring the extreme ecosystems are similar to exploring in space.
Much of what we do in terms of scale and exploration is almost like space science. We have to sample remotely, we have to develop technology to survive extreme environments, extremely high pressure. In the deepest parts of the ocean, we're talking about nearly 11,000 meters deep. So that's, you know, nearly 1,100 atmospheres of pressure. In fact, the pressure is so high at those depths that the water molecules are squeezed together and actually warm up. So these really are very extreme environments. Something we've done sometimes for fun is to actually attach plastic cups or polystyrene cups to our equipment and send it down. And by the time it gets back up, even at a dive to say 2,500 meters, that standard size plastic cup is down to about 1.5 inches in size. So that's a result of all the air in it being compressed. So that gives you an idea of the sorts of pressures involved. What it does mean as well is that if there are any problems with the equipment, it tends to go bang in a very spectacular fashion.
Alex and his team also work on tropical coral reefs, one of the most diverse ecosystems in the world, but probably the most threatened ecosystem on Earth from the effects of global climate change.
Change in the oceans is happening at an extraordinary rapid rate. I mean, that's the thing about the changes. People often talk about global warming in terms of, it was warmer so many thousand years ago or a couple of million years ago. That may be true, but the actual changes in the state of the oceans are happening so fast that life simply hasn't got a chance to adapt to the changes we're seeing. Probably the best example globally is tropical coral reefs, where in the late 1970s we saw the first instance of what was called mass coral bleaching. What happens here is the temperatures rise to a point where the corals have microscopic symbiotic algae in their tissues, and those algae kind of go into a photosynthetic overdrive and produce a lot of reactive oxygen compounds, and the corals basically eject them from their tissues at that point. The corals themselves are also damaged by these high temperatures. Now, of course, the corals rely on these zooxanthellae, they're called, for almost all of their nutrition. And if they remain in that bleached condition, they're called bleached because they go a bright white colour, which is the colour of their skeletons, then they die. In 1997-98, we saw one of these bleaching episodes which killed 16% of all the world's coral reefs in one go. So that is a measure, you know, we actually crossed a tipping point in the late 1970s. Within 20 years, this had got to a point where it was having a global impact on coral reef ecosystems. And basically we're seeing an increasing incidence of these bleaching events through time. And this is ultimately a threat to the continued existence of that particular ecosystem. That's caused by global warming, which is caused by carbon dioxide emissions into the atmosphere. That CO2 is also absorbed by seawater, and that produces something called carbonic acid, which lowers the pH of seawater, causing something called ocean acidification. As a result, the amount of calcium carbonate in seawater is also decreasing. Of course, corals and many other marine animals make their skeletons out of calcium carbonate. So we've got another global problem arising from this whole CO2 emissions issue.
These effects are not simply happening on a global scale.
We were on the seamounts of the Southwest Indian Ridge in 2011, and there we took sediment samples from the seamounts down to depths of 1,500 metres. When we got back here, we were working with the Natural History Museum, and they rung us up and said, well, we've started to look at these sediment samples, and we seem to be finding a lot of plastic fibres in them. I was leading the overall project, and the first thing you think when somebody says something like this is, fantastic, we've made this amazing discovery that plastics are now in the deep ocean. And that was immediately followed by, oh my God, that's absolutely terrible. You know, we've been diving with the ROV in one of the most remote spots in the global ocean, in deep water, and we found that every single sediment sample is full of microplastic fibres. And not only were the fibres in the sediment samples, they were all over the corals we sampled and other critters. So this is an example of something which we do on land, and it's now been estimated that something like 8 to 12 million tonnes of plastic is going into the ocean every single year. It is suspected that those plastics actually absorb other pollutants onto their surfaces, and it's thought that those particles now are so small they're being ingested even by tiny marine animals like zooplankton, that this may be a route for those pollutants to actually get into the food chain. And then of course you get something called biomagnification, where those pollutants are concentrated as you move up through trophic levels, right up to the top predators, things like oceanic fish, which of course we then prey on to eat. And these pollutants of course are lipophilic in many cases, so they are taken up in body fats, and that may be a route through which they actually enter the human food chain, for example.
Alex's findings present a rather depressing picture. So why does he keep working in this area?
When you think about it, many of these problems we actually understand very well. We probably don't need more science, at least for some of the problems, to understand that some aspect of our behaviour is causing damage, and we understand very well the ways in which to actually reduce that damage or even prevent it altogether. One great example of this is fishing. So there are problems with overfishing and with fisheries bycatch and ecosystem damage from certain methods of fishing, such as deep sea trawling, particularly in very vulnerable ecosystems like deep ocean coral reefs and so on. And there we know exactly what the problems are. We know the solutions, basically reduce fishing capacity, so reduce the number of fishing boats, be more selective about the areas we allow fishing to take place, reduce the amount of fish being caught, get rid of what are called bad subsidies, so things like fuel subsidies and so on. There's a whole raft of things we can do to get rid of this problem. There are lots of things we can do as citizens as well. So the obvious one is, I'm endlessly frustrated by is cycling along some of the roads in Oxfordshire and just seeing piles of plastic waste just thrown out of car windows. So just by altering our own behaviour, you know, we can make a difference to some of these things. And of course, there's all this stuff about plastic bags and not using them and so on. These things really do make a difference. We've seen litter everywhere we go in the deep ocean. In the North Atlantic, it's stuff blowing in from land or being dropped off merchant ships or liners or whatever. So these are relatively small things we can do ourselves to reduce impacts on the ocean.
So what are Alex's hopes for the future?
We've only explored about 0.0001% of the deep ocean. So we really want to get a much better understanding of the deep ocean in particular, but ocean ecosystems in general. We really want to shift our level of understanding to the point where we can actually make knowledge-based decisions about the way in which the oceans are used and what we're doing that impacts them. And that really, I think, is our ultimate goal. It's to change the way in which we actually govern the oceans to the point where we can actually have a sensible conversation about. Company X wants to mine deep sea hydrothermal vents in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge or take fish from a seamount in some place. And we can actually say, well, let's look at this. You know, what other ecosystem services are going to be affected by this activity? You know, how does what we get out of that activity actually compare to the impact that that activity is having? And not just the impact on wildlife, but also the impact on the other ecosystem services being performed. And if we can sit in a room and have a sensible conversation like that with policymakers, then we will have moved a long way from where we are now.
This interview was recorded prior to the 2015 United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP21, held in Paris. You've been listening to the Oxford Sparks podcast, narrated by me, Brian McInwells. This podcast was produced for the University of Oxford by Steve Pritchard. For more fascinating science, visit www.oxfordsparks.ox.ac.uk.